podcast in it. And before we start, I just really want to say it's such a shame that Leanne can't be with us. I know we're all very fond of her, and she's just such an amazing writer, and her work on this project has been brilliant. So I just know she'd love to have been here, and I know we're all thinking of her tonight. We're very fortunate, I feel, to have the gifted sound artist Mick O'Shea with us, though. When Paul asked me whether we'd like to have someone to play as we were reading the poems from this project, I suggested Mick because I saw him before and was just really, really taken with his work. What he's going to be playing part of tonight, or one of the motifs that he's going to be playing with in his work, is based around the first pirate radio broadcast that happened in 1916, and was written by James Connolly. It was broadcast in Morse code and picked up in Japan and America, where it made headlines. So he's going to interweave motifs from that through all of his music tonight. And I'm really looking forward to that and hearing a lot about it. And I'm not going to, even though I usually do kind of do introductions before each poem, and it's a terrible habit that I'm a bit too given to the banter, you know. So I'm going to just, at the very start, say a little bit about what I'm going to do. And then I'm just going to go straight into every poem. So a little bit different from what I'm used to. And it's good, I think. So I'm going to start with two poems that are inspired directly by The Rising. The second one is more like a love song dedicated to the proclamation. It says that was kind of the brief we were given as part of this commission to consider the proclamation. So it's just considering it as a text and its kind of physical process of becoming and the kind of alchemy of imagining, it says. But the first poem is based around, I spent ages kind of trawling through the Bureau of Military History collection, which you can get online, and I was very taken by the entry for one teenager, a girl called Mary McLaughlin, and she had a secret message given to her by McDonough which she couldn't deliver. So that would be the poem, the first poem I read, and then I'll read the second poem about the proclamation itself. The second part of my reading is going to be, when I was thinking a lot about 1916 and about the proclamation, one thing that I wondered a lot about was why they chose to produce the proclamation in English only. And that led me to thinking a lot about how Irish is viewed now and what the people who were involved in the signatories of the proclamation would have thought of how we treat Irish now and the studs that they get, we are. So, first of all, I'll make this poem today, and then I'm going to stand up and read some poems for you for me long game.
Thank you.
one February morning, Ina Connolly Hearn sat by a bedside and wrote Miss Mary McLaughlin statement. Mary was feeble, ill, had been bedridden for weeks. Still, she told of her messenger work during the rebellion, of ammunition delivered to the College of Surgeons, secret papers whispering in her fingers, of Pierce's hand on her head when he said, God bless you. She told of hunger and exhaustion, of seeing for the first time in the GPO a whole salmon laid on a dish, and on sending her with a dispatch from McDonough, Plunkett's warning, if by any chance you are stopped, eat this, swallow it, but do not let anyone else get it. Her hips remembered the metal heft of a revolver found on the cobbles and tucked under her belt. In her ear, the click of her mother's key twist in a lock, a sound that left her alone, confined in silence, sheltered from battle shells. Her limbs kept the sensation of fist-smashed glass, of leap and sprint back to Henrietta Lane, through rubble-strewn streets to the GPO and back to McDonough again. She agreed to carry his message to Plunkett in her mouth. Who better to keep a secret than a girl of 15? Yellow Bittern, four secret syllables repeated to herself as she tripped through smoke streets, past barricades, stumbled over rubble and crumpled bodies, over torn scraps of the proclamation. These words gripped behind her teeth. Yellow Bittern, Yellow Bittern. Oh, Yellow Bittern. Oh, struggle of a poet's translated bird who died of thirst. Bird who concealed itself in reeds. Bird made extinct in famine years, when landlords drained wetlands, had small fields merged, turned from thin lengths into large pastures to improve their yield. Old Bittern's song, fading in discord, as its speckled sisters left and took with them their lilts and laments. Mary ran and ran, but never reached the GPO, never passed the words from her lips to Plunkett's ear. None of the three ever met again. For years, she kept that bird behind her lips, unuttered, unheard, neatly folded in the red room of her mouth. Yellow Bittern, four lost syllables that grew to live in her body. And when, on a February day, decades later, Ina visits her house to transcribe Mary's story, she tells it all, finally. She gives voice to the secret words that were meant only for Plunkett's ear. In her mouth, then, the Yellow Bittern wakes, shakes its slender, speckled wings, trembles, stretches itself. Ina leaves, the transcription clipped into a file to be neatly typewritten. Returning weeks later for Mary's signature, Ina is told that she has been given an injection of morphine and can no longer speak. As she leaves, green whispers shiver in the trees all along the avenue. Green, green, the new leaves quiver. And inside Mary's room, the Yellow Bittern clambers up from her throat and unfurls its spittle-wet wings. Unseen, it flits under the sash and stands there on the lip of the windowsill. It tilts its head and sings.
Thank you.
behind a thick layer of museum glass, a copy of the proclamation still sits intact. Gently lit, the paper seems dim, cockled, thin, like seeds scattered in a field of flax, its print. Its capitals call still to Irish men and Irish women in discordant, mismatched fonts, just as it did in the beginning when, from a copy gripped in Pierce's trembling fist, it was read aloud, translated from page to mouth, shouted to the laughing dead, to Sackville Street's crowds of Easter strollers, to passers-by who paused and dawdled a while, or jeered and rolled their eyes. Somehow, this thin page survived flame, survived bomb and bullet, to endure as an untouchable artifact in this glass cabinet. So many of the others were destroyed, thinned, torn, burned, pinned to bombed doors, rain-soaked, gutter-churned, until only singed fragments of them remained. An E from Republic, stuck in a dewy spiderweb. A charred hurt children, tucked under two blue eggs and the twigs of a starling's nest. A secret revolutionary, fallen into a horse's manger, chewed and churned in his convulsive esophagus. And so, most of the copies brought forth by each mechanical sneeze of the rickety printing press were lost within weeks of birth. Some transformed to minuscule flakes of ash, which swirled into a song-filled pub, and were inhaled into the red room of a man's lungs, and exhaled with a cough before the next verse was begun. The paper itself was of a cheap batch. Thin buttermilk tint, bundles bought by Connolly at Swiftbrook Mill, where every day at dusk, carts laden with plump sackfuls of rags would stutter up, ready to be shredded and turned into racks of paper. From shredded pants and skirts, from blankets, darn scarves and shirts, this paper came. From pillowcases, sheets, workmen's overalls, floor cloths, moth-eaten curtains, this paper came. From patched fabric, heated close to the skin of its people, this paper came. From strips of linen and torn cotton, this paper came. Paper that would hold the words, dead generations. In that same year, rags were in great demand as bandages in the trenches of France, to staunch scalp wounds, to soothe eyes from trenches' fumes. Pajama pants cut from the same length of linen may have sent one leg to war and one to this proclamation. That linen had been pounded, pulled and bleached, drawn from flax that grew from seed, scattered in a hillside field, seed that grew into tall stalks, bent by a wind that blew eastwards, sharp as the fierce breeze that would ruffle a dress of red linen years later, a dress worn by a woman who stood watching the horizon with a shawl held at her chin, who could almost imagine distant battlefields while behind her flax rippled in a hillside field. 4. Into that hillside field, a jagged fragment of paper might fall from a city starling's singed wing and float down to stall in that seeded dirt. What may once have been an uttered word, a rag, a garment, a plant, a seed, finally returning to earth. Listen. Something under our tongues is broken. We each feel this shared fissure, a fracture, lurking rupture, where something deep, deep within us goes unspoken. After exams, we throw away textbooks, loaded, unopened, attempt to shed memories of useless vocabularies, cognitive clutter. And still, something under our tongues is broken, sharp, insistent. On these split tongues, we are choking. We swallow all the half-remembered syllables, stuttered, spluttered, and still something deep within us goes. Unspoken now, the hoarded words we learned by heart, the cursed burden, all the old stories and strange phrases we once tasted and turned like something nearly sweet under our tongues. But broken, the enforced bond that knotted us to that molten language. Freed from inherited speech, we shudder, relieved. But in this silence, something within us goes unspoken. Despite the relief of freeing ourselves from the curse of being half wrong in every borrowed word we utter, something under our tongues still persists, remains unbroken. Something deep within us whispers itself and exists, spoken. Vagni din Kushnora, Tal Green Graf the Wamo Marhalin Skola, Agase Kul and Raitora, Tal Grishkini Raka is Re Unola, Karpus Knava, Kusa Rota, Blind the Ire. Der Kids Lee Newton, Govani Gopper, Eglusha, Fui Frolus, Marangnevan Force of Shaftrafer, Kaita. McCrubini are in a pup rinker or Clehan Knick, Tree Hollis Jared Wee, Zangrian Igdal Flee. Under a fridge magnet, there's a photo of grandmother as a schoolgirl. And at the back of the freezer are chops, a rack and legs of lamb, body and bone, frozen limbs, a spark in ice. Newton's first law states that a body will remain in motion at the same velocity unless acted upon by an external force. Absent, the hooflets that skip jigged over a hill to the red-yellow light of sunset. Failed elegy for an abandoned language. We cannot lament that which is not dead. We cannot grieve for that which is still buried in our heads. jaw ajar. Suppose you hold a jawbone so old that the chin has split. A professor passes sample of bone around, explains derelict workout, famine era, a mass grave. He rattles a transparent plastic bag. Inside, a clasher of speechless teeth, a broken grin. He says, a generous selection of fragments, says incremental dentine collagen analysis. For him, you must pinpoint when starvation set in. Suppose you hold the empty jawbone still, two neat halves, one in each hand, the pale bone cool in your palms, and three teeth still tucked into their sockets, snug as heifers working cud in some distant meadow. Suppose you hold those jawbones together and see it not as a broken, inanimate object, but full, skinned, a stubbled chin, a cheek that lived, that was patted, kissed, hit, and between those bones, a mouth that only ever knew the spit and speech of one warm, wet tongue. Suppose you hold this split jawbone to your ear and imagine you hear all he spoke, every sound from his throat. These bones belong to a time when only Irish was spoken. Holding it, you want to return to it some of the words that once resonated through its hollows, but your voice catches in your throat as though something inside you is broken. Suppose the professor approaches, smiling as always, and says, "This is the mandible. What would you call that in Gaelic?" You stare at him, bones in hand, your jaw ajar. Suppose you stutter, your mouth fails. You try to say Curran Gael, but the only sound from your mouth is Curry Gael. Although they won't be mine. Like that story I once found, tucked into a library binder, stories of folklore gathered from people so old that they still spoke the old language, and the story, handwritten in the old alphabet, faded pencil and yellowed paper, the story of that girl, translated, the girl who disappeared. It was in Donegal, back in the days when some girls were stolen during cattle raids, thrown belly over back, never to be seen again. And other girls were taken by otherlings instead, taken into the dark lists, and changelings sent in their place. A terrible thing to have been a young woman then. I'll say that, and I'll shake my head, and the children will look at me with grey eyes, and I'll wonder whether they're concerned for the story girl or for my addled old head, and whether it matters really in the end. The new readers will come and see, and this one man decided to hide his betrothed. And then I'll wink and say, a beautiful girl with long black hair and her eyes grey blue like yours, hand to cheek, and flinch away. But there was nowhere to go. So despite the storms, they rowed her out to sea, their curragh slicing black and black, black and back, back through cold waves, and I would help storming, yes. Waves sharp as broken death. My old hands all smash and splash until it makes the children shiver. And finally, they reached a tiny rocky island and left her there on the beach alone, ankle deep in stormy sea froth. And I will recall how in those pencil words I tasted salt stormed air and felt my own hair lashed and hunger a rock churn in my stomach. But when the men returned for her a week later, presuming to find her hungry, bruised, a little lonely, joyful to see her saviour's return, instead they found the island empty and the girl gone. And I remember how that handwriting moved on. Oh, cows with never-ending milk flow. Oh, strangers met on a dark road. Oh, old women who used magic to show which way to go. But that girl, yes, that girl stayed with me. In my mind, she made a home. And yes, I think I'll tell her story often when I grow old. I'll tell her story to the nameless, pale-faced strangers that come and go to the door of an old woman. A woman who will be faceless, friendless, feet bare on cold stone, and no sound for company, no sound at all, save the wind keening at the window, and I will be alone. The Irish for elephant, the Irish for beauty. While we slept, ice must have crawled through the dark. Crawled through the dark to our street and touched everything. Inside our little house we slept, oblivious to its presence. Soft, our bed, thighs tucked into each other under warm blankets. We dreamt. At dawn, as always, the children clamber in and draw our eyes open with kisses. The questions begin before our feet even touch the stairs and continue through porridge, through brushing each child's every tooth, through face wiping, uniforms, snot and lost shoes. Through it all, I am sipping hot coffee and half answering. Because elephants need heat, I suppose? Yes, instead of a nose. I don't know. Socks on. No. Clusa. Trunk. It's the same in Irish, just the spelling is different. E-I-L-I-F-I-N-T. I don't know, I just know. And what animals lived here long, long ago before this house, before this street and this road? Elephants? Stomping right here? And I say, no. Maybe another house though, with other kids, and maybe a pig or a cat or some chickens in a coop. And I zip them into their fleece-lined coats and throw open the door, and oh, the ice is everywhere. The air is so cold blowing in the door, whipping all the lazy warmth from our lungs, slicing a pause in the patter babble, and making the whole road white. The rooftops of rows and rows of houses where unseen others stir and stretch in their beds. Ice has whitened the steel streetlights the patio furniture, the garden sheds, trampolines, bird feeders, and all the roads between us and our hundreds and hundreds of neighbours, every car and every drive quiet. And in that small second, I see how it would have been for a single small house, thatched, insulated only with toughened mud, where a woman might wake and peer out at this frosted earth, the vast white, and not a neighbour for miles. How she might return inside to stir embers, put breakfast in a pot, to hold children close under blankets and breathe hot on little fists and ankles. Seeing the car iced, I sigh. Go back inside, return with jugs of water to thaw the glass, nod at a neighbour doing the same, and the children humped under satchels are crunching puddles underfoot like consonants. I'm carrying the last jug filled to the brim with warm tap water to slosh over the glass, and I'm distracted by the thought that in lifting this vessel of water to ice, I'm holding the metaphor for a poem that I will never have time to write. I think carrying a vessel, carrying a vessel. I think water, I think ice. I think of the itch to play a Shannos record for the children. In pouring water over the windscreen, I see and startle at a frozen face looking back at me from beyond the thawed glass. But it's only me, of course, only me. Who else could it be? Me with wet feet now and a tired face. Me half answering questions and vocabulary still for the child who asks again. And how do you say window? Window. Fwinioog, I say, and he lisps the syllables wrong. But I don't sigh, I smile and say, yeah, well done. And jug, how do you say that? I can't remember, we have to look it up. Oh, you must know. And how do you say the water is melting? It's melting, melting, melting. Absently, distractedly, I say, oh, I don't know. And then I say, Pán Tishke Olya. And he repeats, Olya, Olya, until in his mouth, mispronounced, it begins to sound almost like Olya. Where decades of diggers' tracks fill with murky puddles, here your phone fails to find the signal. A starling flits past, say, lost. This land was an oak forest once, translated to farmland, then swallowed by a profit crop of unbobbled Christmas trees, say, industrial souls. Say, fall, and a scrape scrawls itself on your hand, red under black mud, the sky darkens. Follow Claude, paw prints, think wolf. At crossroad, choose left. Feel your socks grow wet. Say root and see it. There, a sudden peak that tilts the gap between the trees. Walk towards it fast, hoping for a yard with a jeep, a sheepdog, a cup of tea. Derelict. The house is an abandoned relic. Uninhabited, it draws you towards its locked door. As though you could be an owner, but know that you were a tourist here, nothing more. Under your fingertips, walls crumble, say rubble, and stumble in. Stair steps sag underfoot. Say bed, and you will see it, still pink quilted, with a pillow dotted with fallen plaster. On the sill, a Bible lies open, pages sun-bleached, words evaporated. In layers of wallpaper, in repeated splits of tears, cleaved from old paint below, a broken skin exposed to reveal bone, white plaster underneath. Feel this dwelling shred itself back to brick, back to cracked cement, back to ground where, deep under wild grass, the roots of oak are held still in dirt. Say parlor. There, a chair aims away from the cracked glass of an ancient TV and turns towards the window instead. In wind, a ragged net curtain blows in. Sit. Sit and imagine yourself become someone else. Watch the window as they once did. Birdsong, nettles and brambles sway. A crabapple blossom is drawn through the gap, lifted in to land in your lap. A gift. Another word comes to you then, unsummoned. Law. Who could sing still here? Say starling, bird who fills the air with inherited sound, speckled imitations recalled, passed down, a bird's remembered soundscape. From a stranger's chair, you listen and translate its song. Sheep's bleat, click of wireless, beer bottle hiss, boots click-clack on cobbles, child's giggle, weep gulp, stream babble, chicken claw, switch scratch, strike of a match. Say starling, starling who listens, who lifts shreds of us away, who records and remembers all the sounds we once made. See this little mimic who will sing of us to his sons and daughters. Say inheritance.
Thank you.